Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. In the podcast today, I wanted to talk about a research paper, or basically discuss some recent research. And when I say recent, we're talking March 2025 research that has been done on neurochemical imbalances and long COVID and ME/CFS. As we know, ME/CFS and other complex chronic illnesses are historically under-researched. And so it is always great when we start to see specific research papers being published, which maybe help to give a little bit more clarity on what could be going on in your body in relation to some of the symptoms that you're experiencing, and also just help to get a little bit more credibility, get a little bit more validity in terms of an understanding of this illness so that we can get more support from medical professionals. So this particular research paper was funded by ME Research UK, and they basically used MRI technology to explore the role of neurochemicals in the brain in people who were experiencing long COVID and ME/CFS. So what I'd like to do in today's episode is explain the findings. Obviously, if you have low energy, if you have brain fog, sometimes it's all very well and helpful to know that these research papers are out there, but it can be a whole other thing to read them for yourself, digest them, process them, and really understand what they mean for you personally. So not only do I want to explain what research was conducted and what they found, but then also extrapolate from that and then discuss what I see from this research and how I think it could or could not be helpful for particular individuals on the ground level managing their unique physiology and their unique cases. So I'll talk a little bit about the research, and then I'll also just go into a further discussion about what I think is valuable or not valuable in terms of what has been uncovered. So first of all, just summarizing the research, what did they do? Well, the study took 17 people with long COVID and 17 people with ME/CFS, and also they took a group of people which they refer to as the healthy controls. And they use something called magnetic resonance spectroscopy, or MRS technology, which is basically just a specialized type of MRI scanning. And they use this to measure levels of brain neurotransmitters in a specific region of the brain known as the posterior cingulate cortex. Now, the posterior cingulate cortex is a specific region of the brain that is involved in cognitive processes. It has a very high metabolic rate when compared to other regions of the brain, which means that it very likely also has a high energy demand. And so this particular research looked at specific neurotransmitters in this region of the brain that has a very high energy demand and is involved in cognitive processes. And it looked at glutamate, which is probably going to be the main focus of the podcast today, spoiler alert, something called N-acetyl aspartate, or NAA, glutamine, creatine, phosphocreatine, phosphorylcholine, glycerophosphorylcholine, and inositol. So some of these words might be big and they might not mean anything to you at this point in time, but for now, don't worry too much about grasping everything. This is just basically a summary of what they did. Then what they did is they also assessed symptom severity of the individual participants using a questionnaire, and they also assessed quality of life and functional capacity of participants using a survey. And from this information, they extracted further insight into pain of the individuals, physical function of the individuals, how long they had been ill for, the fatigue they experienced, and unrefreshing sleep. So that was basically the study. They took 17 people with ME/CFS, 17 people with long COVID, a comparable healthy cohort group. They used this MRI technology to assess these specific neurotransmitters in a specific region of the brain known as the posterior cingulate cortex. And then they also compared those findings to the survey and questionnaire data that they had on pain, physical function, duration of the illness, fatigue, and unrefreshing sleep. So after all of that, what did they find? Well, the study found that glutamate levels were significantly higher in patients with long COVID and ME/CFS when compared to the healthy controls. Additionally, they also noted for glutamate specifically, there was no difference between the levels in the long COVID group and the ME/CFS group. And in long COVID specifically, the NAA or the N-acetyl aspartate levels were significantly higher in that group, not necessarily in the ME/CFS group. So it's really important here to kind of bring this back to what it might mean is that glutamate and NAA have important roles in memory, important roles in cognition, things such as attention, learning new information, and decision making, as well as mood regulation. Additionally, levels of these neurochemicals were associated with self-reported severity of symptoms. So coming back to the survey and questionnaire data that they gathered on physical function, unrefreshing sleep, pain, duration of illness, and cognitive impairment, there was a correlation between the levels of these neurochemicals and those markers of health and quality of life. There were no other neurochemicals which showed significant differences between the long COVID, ME/CFS, and healthy controls. However, there were some interesting correlations between symptom severity and neurochemicals in the ME/CFS group, and I'll talk about those in a little bit more detail in a moment. One of the interesting things about the study was that although long COVID and ME/CFS may be considered different conditions, research suggests that 13% to 58% of long COVID patients meet the ME/CFS criteria and exhibit similar symptoms. So the study concluded that there may be overlapping pathology in these two conditions and that the imbalanced neurochemicals may contribute to the complex symptoms experienced by individuals with these conditions. So very basically put, that there's some overlap in how symptoms present in terms of the pathological mechanisms of symptom presentation. There's an overlap between the ME/CFS group and the long COVID group, and that specifically neurochemicals in the brain could explain some of the symptoms that people are experiencing, although there can be many different variables which contribute to symptoms. So what I'd like to do now is just to talk about some of the findings in a bit more detail. Specifically, one of the main focuses of the study was this elevated glutamate. So glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter in the central nervous system, which supports neuroplasticity, it supports cognition, it supports learning, and it also supports mood. So that sounds great, you know, but it doesn't necessarily mean because they found more in the long COVID and ME/CFS group, more isn't better. So if we have insufficient glutamate or if we have excessive amounts of glutamate, then glutamate can become excitotoxic. So it can have an excitotoxicity role, which means it can be overstimulating for the body. And it's hypothesized that elevated levels seen in the two groups may be attributed to pro-inflammatory cytokines and activation of the glial cells, which are cells, immune cells in the brain. And in other words, the higher levels may be associated with inflammation and neuroinflammation. So yet again, you may have heard me say this in the past when I've reviewed previous research papers. It isn't really telling us what we don't already know. I've spoken previously on this podcast about the role of inflammation and neuroinflammation in relation to symptoms, but it is creating research that potentially validates those that hypothesis for that way of thinking. So that is always a good thing, I think, to have more support for the proposed mechanisms. So previous research has suggested that increased inflammatory cytokines may impact glutamate release, transmission, and metabolism, ultimately leading to higher concentrations in the brain. inflammatory cytokines may directly reduce the number of glutamate receptors on the glial cells in the central nervous system. And these cytokines may also decrease the activity of glutamate synthase, which means that this is a particular enzyme which breaks down glutamate. So we're not breaking down glutamate as well. So we've got inflammation, which is essentially driving increased release, increased transmission, and impacting the metabolism because it's not getting broken down. And then we also have a reduced number of receptors in the brain. So in simple terms, inflammation in the brain and the body may result in an accumulation of glutamate in the brain. And this starts to create a feed-forward cycle because we have inflammation. It's causing increased glutamate. Increased glutamate causes more glutamate to be produced, and this further triggers inflammation and cytokine production, which then further triggers more glutamate. So it's suggested that this positive feedback loop, which is what we would refer to this biochemically as, may be a contributing factor in the neuropathology of long COVID and ME/CFS. And so a simple way to understand this might be in a balanced system, we would have a signal, we would have a response to that signal, the signaling molecules get cleared, get broken down, and the system resets. In this type of dysregulated system, we have a continuous signal, there's poor clearing, there's lingering activation, and then we have an ongoing signal. So this sense of lingering activation, and this wasn't in the paper, this is just me trying to bring this information to real life for you, but the sense of lingering activation may show up in real life as this feeling of being wired but also tired, difficulty switching off mentally or difficulty with sensory activity, a sense that the brain is still switched on and processing, low-level restlessness of the mind and body, difficult relaxing, difficulty being able to rest, increased sensitivity to noise, light, or other types of stimulation, thoughts that feel a bit like you're more busy or things are more sticky than usual. There's a sense of underlying unease or activation, and noticing that it takes longer to feel like yourself after doing things. So irrespective of talking about glutamate and inflammation in the brain today, me just looking at that list, that's also what we would call stuck on physiology of the nervous system, or chronic sympathetic activation. And here it's maybe just highlighting that there is a lot of emphasis on the importance of supporting our nervous systems and creating down regulation and supporting more of a regulated nervous system. But sometimes that can be really difficult to do without also addressing underlying physiological processes. Yes, some people can do some somatic work, and obviously I'm trained in somatic experiencing. I do somatic work with my clients. Such a fan of somatic work. And so people can do that somatic work and they can downshift and they can feel really good from nervous system work alone. But sometimes there might also be these ongoing physiological imbalances which we want to support and address to also support the downshifting of the nervous system. And this is just one example of that. So then the next finding that I wanted to talk about was the elevated NAA. And so just a reminder that in this study specifically, they found in the long COVID group, there were higher levels of NAA compared to healthy controls. And it is suggested that this is a compensatory response due to lower brain metabolic efficiency. So basically, the brain is not, it hasn't got enough energy, it hasn't got what it needs. And so as a compensation for that, it's producing more NAA. So NAA, the NAA elevation is more so a symptom of the imbalance versus a direct imbalance, which correlates with symptoms itself. Then in the ME/CFS group, but not in the long COVID group, there were some other neurochemicals, not the glutamate and not the NAA, that were correlated with symptom severity. So we have to just frame here that correlation is not causation. What they basically did in this research is they measured levels of these neurochemicals. They measured symptom severity. And then they said, oh, look, the people who have more of these symptoms also had more of this neurochemical. It's not saying that one is causing the other, but it's just saying, oh, look, there's a correlation between the two. So the first, in relation to physical activity, there was a negative correlation between glutamate and physical activity in the long COVID and ME-CFS group. In other words, the higher the levels of glutamate, the lower the levels of physical activity of the individuals. And just worth mentioning here is that similar findings have also been demonstrated in fibromyalgia patients. So more glutamate, less physical activity. In the ME-CFS group, there was a positive association between glutamine, creatine, and phosphocreatine and physical activity levels. So in this case, when there were higher levels of these neurochemicals, there were higher levels of physical activity. When there were lower levels of these neurochemicals, there were lower levels of physical activity. And this makes sense in some respects. You know, creatine and phosphocreatine are really important for energy. And so if these neurochemicals are higher, there might be more energy and therefore more capacity for physical activity. So the next finding was in relation to cognitive impairment. And in the ME-CFS group, they found lower levels of creatine, phosphocreatine. Remember, I've just said that those are really important for energy. So lower levels were associated with more cognitive impairment, i.e. less brain energy, more cognitive impairment. And previous research has also suggested that cognitive impairment in ME-CFS may be due to depleted creatine levels. So again, we know that creatine can support that immediate energy system of the body, which might be something, there might be some sort of mechanism here. They obviously didn't research the mechanism, but we can hypothesize, at least at this point in time. Then unrefreshing sleep. There was a negative correlation between creatine and unrefreshing sleep. So basically, the less creatine someone had, the more unrefreshing sleep they had. The more creatine they had, then maybe sleep was more refreshing. Then pain. Pain severity increased with increased inositol, and this has previously been reported in fibromyalgia. And then illness duration. It was found that the longer someone had been ill, the lower the glutamine and creatine levels. And that kind of makes sense given some of the other findings as well. And these neurochemicals are involved in multiple metabolic pathways, and decreased levels have been associated with neurodegenerative diseases. So here then, I just wanted to touch on this idea of the long COVID and the ME-CFS overlapping pathophysiology. This was one point that the study really wanted to highlight. So one of the important findings of this study was that there was no significant difference in brain neurochemicals between long COVID and ME-CFS groups. I would actually correct that, and I would say no difference in brain glutamate levels, because there were, in terms of some of the other neurotransmitters that were measured, there were differences. At first glance, that might not seem particularly striking. However, when considered alongside what we see clinically, it does become somewhat meaningful. It suggests that although these conditions may begin differently, so I know some people who have been diagnosed with ME-CFS may have been diagnosed after having a viral infection, but many people are not. And in long COVID, there's a definite infectious virus trigger. So they may not necessarily have the same, they may begin differently, but they share common physiological processes, in this case, the elevated glutamate. And this aligns with what many people experience, a similar pattern of symptoms, including fatigue, cognitive dysfunction, post-exertional malaise, and reduced functional capacity. So rather than viewing these as separate conditions, it might be more helpful to understand them as different entry points to a shared network of dysregulation. And this, I think, is something really important to mention, and I'm potentially going to stand up on my soapbox now, just because I've noticed with some of the things I've been sharing online, you know, some people are quite defensive about how things are defined, how things are categorized. And I get where this comes from. I recently posted a blog as well as a podcast, which the title of which was Not All PEM is the Same. And I talked in the podcast about these three different types of PEM. And especially online, when people can comment, there was a lot of pushback on that, saying, well, actually, only one of these is actually PEM and you're misleading people. And the first one is exercise intolerance. And that is true to a degree. Very, very true. But if I had called that post something else, if I hadn't said not all PEM is the same, if I had said there are three different ways you can respond to exercise or something like that, not as many people would have seen it. Not that I need people to see my stuff for any for my ego or for my own validation, but I want people to see my stuff because I believe in the information I'm putting out into the world. And when people saw that post, it had, especially the post on Instagram, there was a podcast as well and a blog. There was a lot of people who commented on it, a lot of negative comments, but then also a lot of positive comments and people saying, wish someone had explained this to me 3 years ago. I wish I had known that information when I was unwell. It would have really helped me make sense of how I was relating to exercise. So sometimes when we want to have things, appropriately classified and appropriately defined, and we want to put everything in a really nice little neat box, it can actually be limiting in terms of our understanding of ourselves and then how we support our body through this illness experience. And so in the case of the PEM podcast that I did and the blog and the post, it was really just understanding if you respond like this to exercise, this is the type of support that you need. If you respond like that to exercise, these are the things you should focus on. And if you respond the third way, which is the true PEM way, these are the other considerations. And maybe you've got all three and you need a little bit of support for each of them. My perspective is that sharing that information is helpful because people can recognize their experiences and then they can choose the support that they need. But without any conversation around, actually, there's the traditional PEM and then there's these other ways you can also react to exercise and how do we support those? We're not giving people all the information. We're not giving people all the understanding that they need in order to support themselves. And so coming back to now in relation to this particular piece of research and this idea of, and I'll just repeat what I said because it's written here in front of me, which is it may be helpful to understand ME/CFS and long COVID as different entry points into a shared network of dysregulation. So if we say, well, you've got ME/CFS and you've got long COVID, you are different because you have different diagnoses. And therefore, we do the ME/CFS things for you and we do the long COVID things for you. That actually limits us because it limits the possibility that these conditions are basically different flavors of similar mechanisms that are happening in the body. And it's more helpful if we understand the underlying mechanisms and address those underlying mechanisms. And when I'm working with individuals one-on-one, I'm doing this on a N=1 level. Who is the individual in front of me and what are their mechanisms, not just the ME mechanisms or the long COVID mechanisms. Who is in front of me? What's going on in their body based on all the possible things that could be going on? And that's what this paper actually really helps to highlight is that if we are able to understand the underlying mechanisms, then we have more opportunity for support. And so in the case of this network of dysregulation, the network is immune signaling, the network is nervous system dysregulation, the network is energy metabolism, and the network is brain chemistry. And all of these things might need supporting, whether someone has ME or whether someone has long COVID. And again, also on the individual level, based on how they present. So from this perspective, it's less about identifying a single cause and more about recognizing how multiple systems interact and influence one another over time. As I said already, the inflammation drives the glutamate up. Then we get more inflammation, then we get more glutamate. Then we get this excited nervous system. So the way of thinking about this can be helpful. This way of thinking can be helpful because it moves us away of trying to fit symptoms into rigid categories, like I've already mentioned with the PEM example, and instead supports a more individualized and systems-based approach to understanding care. And that is the approach I use with my clients. It is individualized, it is systems-based. We're looking at who is the person in front of me, what have they got going on in their body, and how do we support that irrespective of their diagnosis. So then it is appropriate here to just discuss the study limitations. So no research is perfect. No person is perfect. I'm definitely not perfect. And therefore, it's normal for each study to have its limitations. Although the conclusions from this paper feel very promising, it's important to understand this was a preliminary study. The sample sizes were relatively small, only 17 people in each group, and it focused on one region of the brain. What does that mean for other regions of the brain? We don't know. The study also acknowledges that MRS cannot distinguish between extracellular, outside the cell, and intracellular, inside the cell, glutamate pools. So an increase in central nervous system glutamate could reflect changes in intra and extracellular glutamate, and we don't have that information. So let's come now to the bigger picture. And this is not in the paper. This is Anna telling you what she thinks. So despite the research limitations, the study helps us see possible mechanisms which explain symptoms. But what we also see is the interplay between different systems, as I've mentioned already, brain signaling, immune activity, energy production, and nervous system regulation. This reinforces that symptoms can be multifaceted and why approaches that focus on one layer can feel incomplete. And this is typically what I see if I speak from experience of people coming to work with me. They're doing stuff. Nobody just arrives on my doorstep and not already proactive about their health. Everybody I work with is already being proactive about their health, which is why they've come to me to be further proactive. But there's maybe a layer of work done here and a layer of work done there, but really understanding the layers which are relevant to your case and how they integrate together and doing them so that everything is working as a whole is where the magic is when it comes to recovery. But from this paper, we could also think about this idea of the elevated glutamate levels and what that could potentially mean for possible support, because this was something that was found in the ME-CFS and the long COVID group, and it correlated negatively with physical activity. More glutamate, less physical activity. And what I know from working with so many people who are impacted by these conditions, everybody wants to be doing more. So if we can get the glutamate down, does that mean we can get the physical activity levels up? This hasn't been studied in research. It's a hypothesis, but let's work on how we could support that, getting the glutamate levels down. So in the context of glutamate signaling, some individuals have found medication called memantine to be supportive. And if I sound a little bit awkward when I pronounce these medication names, it's because I don't prescribe medications, so I'm not used to using these words a lot. But memantine works by modulating activity of the NMDA receptors, which are involved in how glutamate signals in the brain. And in certain contexts, this may help to reduce excessive or prolonged activation. There is emerging interest in whether this type of mechanism could be relevant in conditions like ME/CFS and long COVID. However, research in this area is still limited, as you can imagine, and responses may vary significantly between individuals. But if this is something you're exploring, it's important to be done in collaboration with a qualified prescribing practitioner. That would be your doctor or some neurologist who can assess whether it's appropriate for your specific situation. But, you know, in some cases, taking a medication which could reduce these glutamate levels, and if that improves quality of life, it may definitely be worth exploring, especially if you resonate with the symptoms of excessive glutamate. The other thing to consider is diet. You may have come across the idea that a low glutamate diet, particularly in discussions around neurological sensitivity, may be beneficial. I do have one client that I work with who has to keep the glutamate in her diet low. If she doesn't, she feels it. So for some individuals, this can be genuinely helpful, especially where there appears to be heightened sensitivity to more stimulating inputs. In clinical practice, there are cases where temporarily reducing foods higher in glutamate can support a reduction in symptoms such as sensory overwhelm, cognitive fatigue, anxiety, that wired but tired feeling. It's important to acknowledge it's not a universal approach. Not everybody with long COVID and ME/CFS needs to follow a low glutamate diet. And so therefore, it should ideally be explored with someone who's a trained professional so they can guide whether or not it's appropriate for you. Glutamate is a naturally occurring amino acid, and it's found in many nutrient-dense whole foods, and most people will be able to process it without any issues. But removing large categories of food unnecessarily can be stressful psychologically and physiologically, and it can reduce overall diet diversity. So that's something we want to be mindful of. Then what about supplements? There are some supplements which can potentially influence glutamate signaling by supporting the conversion of glutamate into actually more calming neurotransmitters such as GABA. There are also others that help to regulate the receptor activity. We talked about the inflammation reducing the receptor activity, or just supporting some of the broader systems involved, such as energy production, inflammation, and the nervous system. So in clinical practice, things like magnesium, vitamin B6, glycine, and taurine are often considered, and also compounds like N-acetylcysteine may influence glutamate pathways and through its role in the antioxidant systems and glutathione systems. Remember that supplements are supplementary to a good diet, blood sugar control, pacing, nervous system self-care. And sensitive individuals may react to supplements, and therefore any supplements should be taken under the care of someone who knows your case and who is qualified to advise on your case. So we've talked through medications, we've talked through dietary changes, we've talked through supplements, but then I think it's really important to zoom out a little bit and look at this concept of targeted support versus the bigger picture. Although targeted support can be helpful and in some cases very necessary, the study actually highlights the inflammation as one of the possible contributors to the changes in glutamate signaling. And inflammation doesn't just happen in isolation. It can be influenced by a combination of factors like your diet, like your stress levels, like your nervous system, but also nutrient deficiencies, blood sugar imbalances, what's happening in the gut, possible infections, toxin exposure, unresolved trauma, ongoing stresses, heavy metals, mold, and poor pacing. So this kind of brings us back to this idea of when we start to view inflammation through this lens, it's this sort of multiple contributing factors which drive inflammation in the body, then we actually see a lot more opportunities to restore balance in the body. And when we reduce inflammation by addressing the gut, addressing the diet, pacing, nervous system, sleep, blood sugar regulation, you know, all the things I talk about all the time on the podcast, then we can see improved neurochemistry potentially. And this is why this targeted approach in isolation, which is what a lot of people try and do when they're trying to work out how they can help themselves, it can potentially be helpful, but it's usually more helpful to zoom out, look at the bigger picture, start supporting those upstream factors, and work on the body as a whole. And over time, as we work on the body as a whole, we see this downstream impact on inflammation. And then in the case of this particular discussion today, hopefully brain chemistry as well. So my final thoughts on the research, it's a valuable piece of research and it adds to a growing body of evidence suggesting that there are measurable physiological changes underlying symptoms in long COVID and any CFS. At the same time, it's still early. The study is small. It's focused on one area of the brain. It doesn't give us complete answers, but rather many directions for further exploration. And I'm sure that those will come with time. Unfortunately, usually research is behind what we're seeing in clinical practice. Perhaps most importantly, it's highlighting the complexity of these conditions, that what we're seeing is not one isolated issue, but an interconnected system that needs to be understood as a whole. And that is what I strive to do with my clients. So I hope you have enjoyed listening to this today, understanding a little bit more about the research, understanding a little bit more about how we could support excess glutamate practically, and then also again and again and again, coming back to this idea of the big picture and how we support the body as a whole. And so if you are looking for support for your body as a whole, there are various options available. Feel free to check out my website for ways that we can work together. And I will see you in the next episode.